Attention, attention all personnel. It's MASHcast.
Hello and welcome to MASHcast, the show that analyzes and celebrates episode by episode the greatest TV series of all time, MASH, which aired on CBS from 1972 to 1983. Proud member of the Fine Water Podcast Network, I'm your host, General Robert Iron Guts Kelly, and joining us this week in the VIP tent is Lieutenant Maddie W. Hi, Maddie.
Hi, Rob. Thank you so much for having me. Very excited to be here.
We I don't know why I say we. It's just me. I'm the one that does the show, but we are very excited.
It's the royal we.
You and I collectively are very excited to talk about the 22nd episode of season 8, Dreams, a very, very famous episode of the show. The original air date was February 18th, 1980. And boy, howdy, is there a lot to discuss about this episode.
Indeed.
But of course, we have to start at the beginning, which is, Maddie, how did you become a fan of MASH?
It's funny. I feel like a lot of people my age who are on the, you know, millennial Gen Z cusp come to MASH in a variety of different ways. I know a lot of people who grew up watching it on reruns, whether it was TV Land or Nick at Night. Some people who came to it in the pandemic with the sort of explosion of fandom online, specifically on MASHBLR. But I came to it in around summer of 2019. My mom had always been a big fan of MASH when she was growing up. She was a kid when it was first airing. But I hadn't really gotten into it. I'd seen it on reruns, but never had any strong pull towards it. And that summer, while I was at home visiting her, we just sat down and wanted something to throw on as a family to watch together. And I immediately fell in love with the show. I really enjoy the mid-century aspect of it, the ways in which we see so much influence from other pop culture, whether that's other TV and radio infused into that very 70s humor, but also for the political commentary and how relevant it was for an audience dealing with the Vietnam War while still reflecting back on Korea, which was happening 20 years prior. And so blew through the show on Hulu in about a month and a half and found fandom online afterwards and have been so grateful to connect with so many people for whom the show has been so impactful. But one anecdote I will share is that growing up, my mom would constantly quote MASH and I would never know what she was referencing when she was saying these different lines from the show. And I remember very distinctly the first time we watched the episode Henry in Love and I heard the famous Frank Burns line, "It's nice to be nice to the nice." And I gasped out loud being like, "You, Mom, you've been saying this for years and you're quoting Frank Burns? What? How did I not know this?" So that familial connection is what led me into the show, but it's become a huge part of my heart and the media that I enjoy both studying and consuming, broadly speaking, since.
I have used many a MASH phrase in my daily life, and most people have no idea. Don't even know it's a thing, right? They just think it's some weird thing that I'm saying. But it's always pulled from the annals of MASH. Now, I was going to ask you, but you already answered the question, which I'm always fascinated when I talk to somebody who discovered the show, you know, recently.
Sure.
What they then do, because some people, of course, on MASHBLR specifically, like, are stretching it out. They're doling it out two a day, one a day, because they don't want to burn through it. But you burn through it, right?
And did I burn through it, I picked episodes based on the Hulu description of what I thought looked interesting. So I didn't even watch the show in order the first time around.
That's called the machete way of watching MASH.
Precisely. Recreating the feeling of like catching whatever episode happens to be on in reruns, but, you know, going, oh, this plot about BJ looks pretty interesting. Or, oh, this one features Potter, you know, musing about X, Y, and Z. I'll check this one out. And I then went back and watched them all in order. But that first initial experience, I think, was really fun, if a little disjointed, and just getting a sense of what are the types of stories that these screenwriters are interested in exploring. How do we see these characters start to build, even if it's out of order? And what are these bigger ideas that we think are still relevant, you know, over 50 years from the initiation of the show? So it was in a unique way. It's not necessarily one I would recommend in terms of getting somebody into the show. But
right.
There was some merit in the experimentation.
I wonder if there's one of the streaming channels offers this service, right? Is like a randomizer kind of thing?
Sure.
Or you could just, I know that like Disney Plus has all 10,000 Simpsons. Like, could you just hit a randomizer and it just plays them random in case you don't want to just go season one, all the way through. Because when I watched MASH in syndication, they ran it tw they ran it 4 times a night in two clumps. They ran it from 7 to 8 and then 11 to midnight. But the 7 to 8s were back to back, like season 4, season 4, and then the one at 11 would be season 7, season 7. They were on separate
Oh,
strips. So
interesting.
you would, like, oh, okay, over here they're running this era, and later at night they're running this era, because it would be two different things. So there is that. I kind of got the both worlds there. It was kind of like, all right, I'm
Nice.
following this season, but I'm also following this other season with these other characters here, and then the show looks different. Why is all that kind of stuff? So, well, that's fascinating. It's funny you mention about the dates of the show. When you think about the first episode, right? It says Korea 1950, 100 years ago. We are now 3/4 of the way there to that being 100 years ago. We're now 75 years in. Like, oh, Lord. Woo.
Which is so trippy, right? I mean, to think about not only the, geopolitical impact of this police action, to use the parlance of the day, but also to think about, the distance between the war itself, the show, and then our distance as audience members in 2026 from 1972. All really interesting to think about in terms of just how do we see the continual relevance of the show as a whole in that way.
Completely. So, as I mentioned, we're here to talk about dreams, and this is this. I've said on and on that season 4 of the show is my favorite, not only my favorite season of MASH, my favorite season of television, period. I just think it's the funniest, and it's also, I love that they experimented with the format. But this is them experimenting with the format in season 8, right? We already had the Lifetime
Absolutely.
episode, which is a more of a, not a thematic experimentation, but a form, experimentation and experimentation in form. But this is both. And it's kind of funny that as people were emailing me about the episodes, which ones they wanted to do, I got a bunch of people that said, this is the one, these are the ones I'd like to do, this, this, and this. And if I can't get those, I'll even take Dreams. As if Dreams is this kind of, and I was sort of like, is Dreams not a popular episode in MASH fandom? I always thought it was, but there seemed to be a bunch of people that regarded it as like, oh, if I have to, I guess I'll take that one. And I was like, huh, okay. I was
So
really looking forward to talking
interesting.
about this one because I love this episode. It's a format buster. It doesn't totally work in some respects, and we'll get to all that, but
Indeed.
props to them for trying something different 8 seasons into the show.
Absolutely. It's such a radical departure from even how we've seen the show's tone evolve from, season 4 onwards with the addition of new characters, with sort of the changing politics of the time. We have this show that is completely, this episode rather, that is so completely removed from what we saw in the pilot or even what we saw in, say, seasons 4 and 5. As you pointed out, it's totally playing with genre, it's totally playing with form. And I appreciate Alan Alda and the rest of the writers in that room for going there, for showing something that's such a radical departure from that which we've come to know. With the show on the whole and taking some major storytelling risks. I think that mostly pay off, but some of which don't. I'm sure we'll get to that as well. But I think that for the experiment, it is such a valuable episode. And I think that's what makes it stand out to me amidst the rest of season 8. But even that being said, the back half of season 8 has some of the strongest episodes of this era, in my opinion, starting with, for me, Stars and Stripes, all the way through to the end. That is one of the strongest periods of the show for me. And I think Dreams really reflects that team's willingness to try new things, even with a show that had been on the airs for 8 years at that point.
Yeah, completely. So yeah, you mentioned the writing, and this episode is credited to Alan Alda and James J. Rubenfier. That's a like who is that? We will talk about that a little later on, and it was directed by Alan Alda. So, all right, so this, yeah, there's a lot to discuss. So let's get to the plot of this episode. The 477th is hit by the biggest batch of wounded they have ever seen, driving everyone in camp to the point of complete exhaustion. No one has time to sleep any more than an hour or two at a time, and we get to see some of the bizarre, sad, and even nightmarish dreams that they have. Margaret dreams of herself on her wedding night in a passionate embrace with her groom, but then a line of soldiers march by and her husband leaves her, marching off. Her bed is then filled with bloody wounded soldiers reaching out to her for help. We last see her standing in a field, her wedding dress stained with blood, as she stands there looking stunned. BJ catches a nap during a break from surgery. He dreams of his wife, Peg. They are dancing at a fancy party and stroll their way into the OR. Colonel Potter interrupts them, asking BJ to perform an operation. He does, ignoring Peg. She stands there for a moment or two and then walks off. Potter falls asleep in his office, and his dream starts with a horse wandering in. Potter, now dressed in his World War I uniform, climbs aboard, playing polo with a live grenade. As the grenade explodes into fireworks, Potter then stumbles across his boyhood home and sees himself riding a horse, hearing the sound of his mother calling him to dinner. Winchester dreams of himself as a magician, performing tricks and entertaining the other members of the camp. A patient is wheeled out, and Winchester tries greater and greater tricks, but the patient gets worse, leading Winchester to try more and more to no avail. He's finally left tap dancing and twirling sparklers. He wakes up from his, sweating profusely, muttering, "Damn." The recovering patients are piling up so much that all the beds at post-op are turned into bunk beds, and Father Mulcahy takes a moment to hear one patient's confession. But he's so exhausted that he falls asleep, the patient's confession turning into gibberish. Mulcahy dreams of himself dressed in flowing, glowing robes, and he is welcome to his pulpit like the Pope. He begins to speak to his flock when suddenly drops of blood splatter his Bible. He looks up, and what was a statue of Jesus is now a bleeding soldier, and the pews full of parishioners is now an OR. Klinger dreams of himself back in Toledo, where he wanders windy, desolate, empty streets. He stops at Tony Paco's, where inside is an OR. There he sees Potter calling him inside. On Potter's operating table is Klinger himself. Klinger is happy to be awakened from this dream by Kelly, who tells him that Potter wants him to patch through a call. Potter gets a wounded general to make a call to a nebbishy pirate who refuses to send ambulances to pick up the wounded. After being threatened, the private relents, meaning the 477th will finally be getting some relief. With the crisis mostly over, everyone meets up in the mess tent. Hawkeye is so exhausted he falls asleep at the table, and he dreams he's back in med school. He has fallen asleep, and his professor takes it out on him by removing Hawkeye's arm, in this instance, a mannequin arm, and tossing it into a river. When the professor asks Hawkeye what the procedure is to reattach a limb, he can't answer, apologizing for being asleep. The professor responds by removing Hawkeye's other arm, also tossing it into a river. Hawkeye then finds himself armless in a boat filled with severed limbs. He spots a bleeding little girl and is helpless. He then finds himself in front of an operating table where a nurse hands him a scalpel. Armless, he screams into the heavens, waking himself up. Now fully awake, he sees there are more wounded arriving, and he heads out of the tent. Later, everyone is back at the mess tent. They all plan to go back to their tents and sleep, but when Winchester absentmindedly quotes, "Ah, sleep, perchance to dream," everyone sits back down for another cup of coffee. So, apologies, everybody, for an extra long synopsis there. But of course, there were seven dreams to cover, and I didn't want to cut any of them out because that would sort of be inappropriate. So, that's this is, you know, this is a big episode. Before we get to the show itself, I do want to ask you, Maddie, do dreams factor into your life very much? Do you give them much credence? Do you bother to track them, or is this just not something that's relevant in your life?
That's a great question. I feel like more as an adult, I've paid more attention to my dreams. I feel like in, early undergrad through early grad school, I didn't really pay that much attention, nor did I think I dreamed that much. But funnily enough, my PhD thesis advisor and committee chair taught a class specifically about dreams and performance, and he had us keep a dream journal, keep track of our dreams, try to, pick up on recurring motifs, reflect back, maybe not trying to solve the puzzle of what the dream actually means, but how it can, reflect back on our waking life, so to speak. And these days, if there's a particularly, moving or interesting image that I happen to remember from my dreams, I write it down. No patterns found yet, but maybe at some point I'll be able to track the data and see what's going on in my psyche in that way.
Okay. Yeah, I don't pay a lot of attention to them. Once in a while, I'll have one that is kind of grim and it wakes me
Sure.
up. And then I just get sort of frustrated at my own subconscious. I'm like, well, why did you put that in there? What was the point of that? What are you showing me that for? Most of my
Right.
dreams, most of my dreams tend to be frustration dreams. Like I can't accomplish something or I can't move or something like that. So, but I don't, the brain is such a mysterious organ that I don't waste a lot of time kind of not waste, but I just don't spend a lot of
Sure.
time thinking of it that way. I just kind of like, well, that was odd, and then I just move right on. But, the one time, the one brief story, not that this episode is not going to be long enough, but the one brief story I will tell where my dream, I felt like my dream manifested into reality was a bunch of years ago. I had a random dream featuring Jane Fonda, the actress Jane Fonda, right?
Amazing.
Now, I don't have a great opinion about Jane Fonda one way or the other. You know what I mean? Like, I don't dislike her, but I don't particularly
Sure.
like her either. I've liked her in movies, but it just doesn't really figure into my life in any real way. And I'm like, why was Jane? And I hadn't just watched
Yeah.
a movie with her, and I was like, why? That's odd. Okay, well, whatever. And then randomly, 6 months later, 8 months later, I was doing an episode of my Bob Dylan podcast that's no longer around, Pod Dylan, and I had a guest on who randomly is her ex-son-in-law. And
Whoa.
I didn't know that when I booked him. He
Sure.
told me in between booking him and coming on the show that who he was, and I was like, "Oh, wow, that's weird." And we happened to be talking about an episode about a song that mentions dreams, and I mentioned this to this guy, and without telling me, he went and told Jane, and she
Whoa.
autographed a picture quoting Bob Dylan lyrics about dreams to me, and it came in
That's
the mail. And
spectacular.
so he like he
Wow.
like a year earlier, I had a random dream about Jane Fonda, and then now Jane Fonda, at least for 5 minutes, knew who I was. I'm like, that was my
Yeah.
subconscious manifesting something in some very strange way. So make of that what you will.
There's something to it. I think there's something to it. The merging of all of those in that sort of premonition way
Yeah.
seems like there's a there there.
Something there. Something to unpack later on. And as I, if I decide to go to therapy someday. But okay. So let's talk about dreams. It opens up in the mess tent, and we see that we see Margaret and Hawkeye and BJ, and they are mostly like kind of half asleep, but we're getting the PA announcer is talking, and there's already in this nice little detail where he talks about that there's more wounded coming in 15 minutes, and he says, haven't had wounded for a half an hour. What is this anyway?
Right.
And the way he doesn't say it, and he doesn't say it the way you would say it. Normally you would say, what is this anyway? But he says it, what is this anyway? Which is just not the normal way you would say it. And that immediately to me puts you ill at ease, right? You're like, what? That sounded odd. Why is that? And that's the whole episode's going to be
Absolutely.
odd like that. So it's a fun little detail.
Especially because the announcer oftentimes is our source of levity in these episodes. We get some commentary, we get a sense of where we are in time and place, like when they're reading the news announcements. And to have that slight little, sonic oddness of the phrasing, I think, as you put very well, signals that something's up. Something's not quite right with what we're seeing so far, or hearing in this case.
Yeah, you're like, was that a mistake? Or is like, no, that wouldn't
Right.
be a mistake. That's clearly the way he meant to say it, but what an odd way to say it. So, okay. So then BJ talks about that. He says there's a little restaurant in Sausalito where a seagull sits on the window, and he says you can tell from the look on its face it has absolutely no idea that people shoot at each other. And I have mentioned this on many other episodes, my whole love of California, long before I ever went to California, came directly from all the references BJ would make. And this was one of them, right? Because I was like, ooh,
Yeah.
that's a, oh, there's like a little cafe in Sausalito where the seagulls sit on the windowsill. That sounds awesome. And I got to go to
Right.
Sausalito as part of my honeymoon. So it was very exciting. I felt like I manifested that in a weird way. But this was one of the, one of the, oh, I gotta check out Sausalito sometime. That sounds really cool.
I love that whole line, and I love the way in which Mike Ferrell delivers it, too. It's just, you can feel the exhaustion, you can feel the weight of everything, and just focusing in on this one little image of the seagull with the French fry is how he's grounding himself in this moment. And that quotation to me always really resonates with this sounds a little, out there, but it resonates for me with the story of Odysseus on his journey home, leaving Ithaca. And the story goes that, The ghost that he runs into tells him to pick up an oar, and the further you walk inland, once somebody mistakes that oar for a shovel, then you'll know that nobody has been troubled by the sea, and this is where you can find peace. I'm also, paraphrasing the television show Black Sails, which references this specific story too. But I think it's really interesting that the way he phrases it is, when I get out of here, I'm going there every day until I get that same expression on my face. And just how much the idea of home, the idea of Mill Valley, of normalcy, is that lifeline that he clings on to, which we certainly see with his dream and the ways in which we see his elements of home via Peg showing up.
Yeah, that's it. Wow, we're mentioning Odysseus this early on in the show. This is going to be a gangbuster episode, everybody.
Let's go.
That's what you get when you book a professor onto MASHcast. And then so Hawkeye then kind of dumps on that and says, I don't think we'll ever get out of here. They've tattooed our brains with this ugliness and we'll never get it off. Now, first of all, it's like, thanks for that, Hawkeye. I appreciate it. But I think that will play into an observation that I'm going to have later on in the episode, but I just want to earmark that. I think that's a line that is maybe not necessarily meant to pay off, but I think it accidentally does in some way a little
Absolutely.
bit later on in the episode. So, Margaret says, well, I'm going to go back to my tent and get a couple minutes sleep. Hawkeye makes a half-assed, quarter-assed attempt at flirting with her, which he doesn't mean. She knows he doesn't mean it, and that's the effort he puts into it. So then she goes into her tent, and of course, if you're watching MASH, right? The 25 million people that watch the show every week, this just seems like a normal episode, right? You're
Totally.
just kind of like, all right, where are they going with this? And then Margaret sits on the on her bed, and then we pan over, and then all of a sudden we see this blinding white light, and now we know, oh, we are. This is a different episode of MASH than we typically get because we see Margaret in a wedding dress and then she wanders
Yes.
out and she goes into this field and she's in this big, she finds this out in the, she does, she kind of runs and she embraces this generic looking groom, not Donald Penobscot, by the way, not, or
Correct.
not meant to be Donald Penobscot. This is actor Ray Lynch, who only had one credit previously, a film called The Zodiac Killer in like 1970.
Oh, interesting.
How does he end up in an episode of Matt? I don't know.
Right.
He's got a very modern look with that mustache. It's kind of a BJ mustache.
It's
And
so funny. It
yeah.
takes me out. It's the one part of Margaret's dream where I'm like, this is the most 1979 man to ever pop up on a show where oftentimes people look slightly out of time, but he is the one detail where I'm like, ooh, all right, knock off Mike Farrell, let's go.
Margaret dreams of Burt Reynolds, apparently. So,
Yeah. Good taste.
yeah, they kiss, and then a bunch of troops walk by, and the groom gets up and sort of silently. By the way, I mentioned, I didn't mean to infer this that, except for the Hawkeye dream, there is no dialogue in any of these dream sequences. Character when Potter does something, as I mentioned in the synopsis, he's gesturing. He actually isn't talking during any of these sequences, and so the groom just wordlessly gets up and starts marching in formation. Margaret watches him march off, and then all of a sudden, a bloody hand comes out and reaches for her, and she sees that the bed is got a bunch of wounded soldiers, and she sort of recoils in horror. I guess it's probably, maybe this is the good time to mention, if you look in the complete book of MASH by Susie Coulter, there is a still from this scene featuring Hawkeye, and
Handing her the instruments, right?
Hawkeye,
It's
yeah, Hawkeye does not appear in the stream, which means there are deleted scenes of MASH, which means some of us have got to be sent to the lot of 20th Century Fox now owned by Disney to try and find this material. I'm very
right. I want to
frustrated.
know what was up there. Like, it's in the shooting script as well. In the final script, it indicates that Hawkeye is there waiting for Margaret to hand him the instruments so that way they can operate. And I think that ultimately, in my very humble opinion, they made the right choice in removing Hawkeye. I think that there's something about their relationship and the closeness and trust that would have come with seeing him in that moment. But I think that it really highlights how isolated Margaret feels in this moment. She is surrounded by this chaos. She is standing there helplessly with her hand stretched in front of her. And it just goes to show again that impact of the war, how she's made these choices in her life to, go full pro army, and how she's now grappling with this in this moment where she feels totally, totally isolated and lost to, as to what to do.
Yeah, you don't it having Hawkeye there doesn't really add to anything. You kind of get it. Like, okay, she wants to help these, she's horrified, but she of course would want to help but these soldiers, but she can't because she's not, she
Exactly.
doesn't have any impl, you know, she doesn't know. And then we get a slow pan out of her standing there in the middle of this field with her wedding dress covered in blood. And so that is the end of her, of Margaret's dream. Then we are back in OR and we see that they are just piled up with patients. The 863rd has bugged out, so they're saying that they can't even send troops to the 863rd to get a little relief. And so Klinger is told, you know, we'll go find them. They're somewhere. And once we figure out where they are, we will send them some patients. And of course, Hawkeye's talking to Nurse Connie. Connie is A, by the way, that she gets a line here. And then BJ starts getting a hand cramp. And he realizes that he needs a break, and then Hawkeye takes over for him. He, first of all, he initially is like, no, I'm fine, I'm fine, I'm fine. But Hawkeye insists that he take over, and then BJ heads out and lays on a cot and starts talking to a soldier, starting to a wounded soldier, and he pulls out a picture of Peg, who I don't think we've seen to this point, right? I don't think we've ever seen a picture of Peg.
This is the first time she actually appears, even though we don't hear her until Oh, How We Danced.
Oh, how we dance. Yeah.
Nice to have a face to put to this name, who we've heard about for 4 seasons and we've gotten letters and care packages from, and clearly is so important in BJ's life. And now we finally get to see her, silver shoes and all.
Right. She is played by actress Katherine Bergstrom, who, as you just mentioned, would come back to the show next season for Oh, How We Dance, with a nice little bit of continuity that they brought back the same actor. She was only in a couple of movies outside of this credit. She's in Cheech and Chong's next movie, and she's in Halloween 2, of all things. I think, unlike the guy, Margaret's groom, I think she
Yeah.
looks like a 50s housewife with her haircut. I think
Agreed.
she's plausibly a 50s housewife.
And that giant boutonniere really grounds it in the era. But yeah, I think she's spectacular in this, and so hard to, convincingly represent the relationship between a married couple with no dialogue in this surreal sketch of a dream. Like, how do you even go about thinking about character motivations and objectives, and how do you accomplish that when you literally don't have text to work with in that sense? And so I think she does a really amazing job with this first introduction to who Peg is.
Yeah. And so they're at like some sort of fancy dinner party, and there's like a waltz. There's even like a little bit of kind of musical number to it, where we do a pan in of the big overhead light as it sort of looks sort of like MGM glamour
Yep.
films of the 1930s. And as he starts to him and Peg starts to dance by, Potter stops and requests that BJ perform surgery, and BJ turns over and ignores Peg. We see that he doesn't even really seem to pause. He immediately grabs the scalpel, turns his back on Peg, and we watch Peg as she slowly gets pulled sort of out into another room by some other guys dressed in tuxes, and she sees that BJ is no longer paying attention to her. And so I find it interesting that in a couple of these dreams, Potter, of course, will represent the thing that is interrupting these people from their idealized situation. Potter's the inter I mean, you know, I mean, he's the commander. And it's
Right.
not like BJ, I would think, regards Potter as like, well, this guy could send me home if he wanted to, the way Winchester does. But I
Sure.
just think it's interesting that Potter is kind of the it's not just BJ is seeing a patient and he works on him. It's Potter that literally taps him on the shoulder and is like, no, come over here.
I really love how you detailed that, because it shows not only the immediacy of the relationship and that Potter is their boss, he is the commanding officer, he is the one who is directly telling everybody what to do. But on the other hand, he still very much represents regular army. We still have that impact of the shift between Henry's leadership and Potter's leadership. And so I think that there's something really interesting to tease out there with regard to thinking of Potter, who is not an antagonist by any stretch. They've come to love and appreciate him totally by this point. But in terms of what he represents as this more antagonistic force or representation of the system that is keeping them from what they really desire is fascinating to me.
Then we're back in the OR, and they can't evacuate. On top of the fact that they're getting too many patients and none of them are going to the 63rd, they can't even evac the ones they do have because there's a lieutenant in I-Corps who will not send ambulances because there's apparently so much fire going on that he's afraid that the ambulances are going to get hit. So not only are they patients are flooding in, they can't even evac the ones that they do have. Potter gets frustrated and storms off, and he says the new patient comes in and he tells Hawkeye, somebody get somebody on this patient. And Hawkeye says to, at this point, there's only Hawkeye and Winchester. And he says, Charles, work on it. And Charles just says no, which I didn't know that
Which
he
is
could
wild.
do.
He's just like, no, which was very in character for Charles. But it's like, buddy, don't you see what's going on all around you? I understand everybody's tired, everybody needs a second to breathe, but like, you gotta take one for the team here, bud.
What is that about? I mean, I know that he's a major and Hawkeye's a captain, but Hawkeye is chief surgeon, which Winchester points out because then
Right.
Hawkeye says, "Well, who's going to work on that patient?" And he says, "Well, as chief surgeon, chiefly you," which is,
Right.
real dick move there on Winchester's part. So, okay.
Entirely on brand. And also, it's like, okay, Charles, we got to get you to read the room a little bit more here. We'll get you there.
So Potter, we find Potter in his office, and he is arguing with the Lieutenant Garvey, played by actor Rick Wallen, only had a handful of credits. He was on an episode of Barney Miller. He's in the cult movie Eating Raoul. Again, I get
Oh, nice.
the random things people are in, right, when they did a MASH. And we see that this guy is clearly sitting in comfort. He's eating a sandwich. He's got a cup of coffee. Like, he's not sweating it at all. And he keeps saying, look, if they blow up these ambulances, they're going to take it out of my pay, and I'll be paying this off the rest as long as I live, which
Right.
I don't think that's how that works, right? I don't.
I don't think so. I don't think that that's how the army is billing people. But it's very funny because it feels like a very old school plot. That feels like a season 2B plot of, oh, they can't get the ambulances to come because X, Y, and Z reasons. Sort of punching up or yeah, punching up a little bit with regard to the sort of bureaucracy and silliness associated with the structure of the army. So it's nice to have a little bit of levity there amidst what is, on the whole, a much heavier episode.
And that, right, he does feel like a character that Hawkeye and Trapper would have run into at some
Absolutely.
point during trying to get ribs or something like that. So
Yes.
Potter barks to Winchester to excuse me, I always do that. He barks to Klinger to say, get me General Embry on the phone. Meanwhile, he falls asleep. And then we see presumably Sophie. We don't, I don't,
Right.
I can't tell horses, but presumably it's
Right.
Sophie. She wanders into his office, and we see that Potter is all of a sudden, kind of wearing his, not, he's wearing his boots from his kind of World War I uniform. We get a down shot, which we very rarely get on MASH, right? As
Absolutely.
Potter and Sophie wander out of the wall, like they remove the wall and they wander out of the set, and we see Potter, and there's two Chinese soldiers, and one of them pulls a grenade, throws it in Potter's direction, and Potter just pulls out like a croquet mallet and hits it, and that turns it into fireworks, and it shoots it off into the sky, and he looks kind of happy. And then we hear a young woman yell, "Sherman, Sherman Potter," and we see a young boy on a horse who is clearly the young Potter. That is played by an actor, but mostly stuntman, named Curtis Upper, who has gone on as a stuntman, has had quite an amazing career, still working to this day. He's done stunts for movies like Too Fast, Too Furious, Bad Boys 2, The Italian Job, The Rock, Showgirls. I don't know, so
Good for
and
him.
yeah, I you know it was kind of when I saw it, I thought, you know what, I bet that's a stunt performer because he doesn't have any lines. And I bet that they wanted, because it is clearly like a young kid, and they probably wanted someone that had a facility for riding horses. And so we see Potter watching as his young self is being called to dinner, and he smiles, which makes this, as we're going to see, the only dream that isn't nightmarish. It's the
Right, the
only happy
only
one.
happy one.
Yeah.
It's so fascinating to me. What did you
And
make of that?
well, that's what I was saying about the line with Hawkeye about saying they've tattooed our brains with this ugliness and we'll never get it off. Everyone else has an anxiety that they will never recover from this experience because they are young. Potter is in the back nine of his life, the back third of his life,
Right.
and he's been through two previous wars. He's not feeling scarred by this to this extent. He knows he will move on. The others don't know because they've never gone to a war before, but he does know it. So he's dealing with it in a different way subconsciously than the rest of them are. I think that's what Hawkeye's line is. He has an anxiety of, like he mentioned in the previous episode, a couple episodes back, the bottle fatigue, right? Where they
Yeah.
say, oh, our drinking will slow down once we go home. And he goes, how do you know that? I've never gone home from a war before. None of them have experienced this, but Potter has. So
Right.
Potter just has fond reveries of a simpler life. He's not worried about that this is going to scar him forever.
I really appreciate that framing because it's something that I grapple with this one dream is just why is his, the most lighthearted of everybody's? Is it because he's used to it? But I think what you framed really well is the fact that we see Potter's anxieties manifest in a variety of different episodes, and it usually has to do with his anxiety about getting older, being too old for the job, losing the people who he has gone through these heavy traumatic experiences with. And so he knows that he will come out the other side, whereas if everybody else has not experienced that, it makes sense the ways in which their anxieties are manifesting. So I like that examination of why this is the lightest or least depressing to phrase it that way, dream of the seven. Like he can't escape the impact of the war just the same way that everybody else, but it is, again, a sort of different perspective on what comes after this. What is that thing I'm clinging on to? It's that notion of I will make it through versus what happens on the other side.
Yeah, we've seen that Potter regards his World War I time as a grand adventure.
Right.
And it's not that the war doesn't show up in the dream because the Chinese soldiers come and throw a grenade at him, but what does he do with it? He hits it
Right.
like it's a ball, and it turns into fireworks. It's completely not threatening at all. And so that's Potter just isn't riddled with that particular anxiety you just mentioned. He's riddled with other anxieties.
Yeah.
But not this one in particular. And so Klinger wakes him up and says, I can't get General Embry on the phone. More wounded are coming. I can't get the ambulance, the lieutenant even on. He won't answer the phone anymore. And he's like, sorry, I had to wake you. And then Potter says, I wish you could have given me one more minute. It's been a long time since I tasted one of her home-baked muffins. And of course, Klinger is, what the hell? What the hell is he
Right.
talking about? And so that is our act break, the end of the first half of the show. And I would love to know the ratings breakdown, right, of this episode
Right.
of like, did it go, did it fall? Did people at the first break go, I'm not into that. I want them to be
Right.
wacky. I don't want to see this one. I'd love to know what that was, you know?
Oh, that's so funny to think of it. Like how many people were like, eh, I don't need this. Too much, too weird.
Yeah.
Not enough plot.
What else
Not
is
funny.
on at 8 o'clock? What other show was on? Can I watch Mork and Mindy or something? I don't want to watch. This is too heavy. I'm not into this. I don't know. Maybe not. Maybe they held the audience because MASH was massively popular by season eight. So
Absolutely.
we come back and we see Winchester is taking a nap. I can't tell from the setting exactly where they are. Right? It's
Right.
not the swamp. So where there's a lamp that I don't recognize. So it's somewhere. I just don't recognize where it is.
Right. Like it could be any one of the static sets that they had in that sound stage. My guess was probably the VIP tent because it seems to not be, anybody's individual tent.
Yeah,
Also,
probably.
Charles sleeping among the plebes is really something too to enter into this dream. But then when we get that reveal when the tent wall goes up, it's clear that we're again in that surreal dream world right away.
Yep. And we see that Potter, I do this all the time, Winchester is dressed like a magician. And he walks in and he starts performing for Klinger and nobody else, right? It's kind of interesting. It's all kind of the background players that are clapping, and Klinger is there, and he's pulling flowers out of his head. He's doing all these kind of standard magic tricks. And then Klinger actually has a hat that he starts taking sort of collections for. People are throwing, oh, excuse me, Mulcahy is there. Mulcahy is in the background. I'm incorrect. And so they all start putting money in the hat and stuff. There's an interesting little detail where Klinger has got these diamond, very noticeable diamond earrings on, and they will disappear from shot to shot, depending on where we're seeing it. And I've seen people online say, oh, it's a mistake. And I'm like, well, it's a dream. It doesn't need to, you know, sometimes they're there, sometimes they're not. We're not a reality anymore.
And he does drop one of them into the hat, which I think is nice. But I also caught my eye with that in terms of, how many he has on in between shot to shot. But also, this is one of the last times we see Klinger with earrings, outside of when he breaks out some of his old outfits for, one last gasp later
The
on.
Cleopatra outfit, yeah.
But, there's very few instances of him wearing dresses or any other feminine accessories from this point on, as we see him fully taking on the Radar role and Jamie Farr wanting to step away from wearing those costumes behind the scenes. It's interesting how we see those sort of last vestiges of the early years popping up in these moments.
Yep. So then the crowd parts, and there is Potter again, once again, for in these dreams, Potter is sort of the not the angel of death exactly, but he's certainly not a figure of levity in any of these dreams,
No.
because he starts bringing in a patient, and it's, by the way, the patient is the same extra that was the patient in Lifetime. It's the same actor who would end up being in the show all the way till the final season of the show. Winchester starts pulling handkerchiefs, colored handkerchiefs, out of his mouth, and as a way of kind of like, oh, is that going to mollify the patient? And you see it sort of stops him for a minute, and then he starts to choke, and then Winchester pulls a deck of cards out and does all, it turns them into larger cards, and none of this works. And then it works temporarily, and then the guy goes back to choking, and we see everyone else is sort of watching Winchester, sort of like, well, what are you going to do? And nothing seems to work. Nothing of this. The guy continues to choke until eventually Winchester is sweating profusely, and he's left to doing a tap dance while whirling sparklers around in this sort of pathetic last-minute gesture. And then he wakes up from the dream, and we see him again covered in sweat, and all we hear him say is damn. And so that's the end of Winchester's dream.
It's so haunting, and DOS is such a fantastic actor in his own right. He really, you feel the pathos, you feel just the stress, the wanting to show off at the beginning, which is very much Charles's way, and wanting the recognition of those skills. But when it's not having the impact that he's intending to save this patient, he doesn't know what to do. And we get these series of tight shots of the people who are observing him. We get Claire, we get Mulcahy, and then we get this tight shot back on Charles as we just see all of it start to dissolve. He does not know what to do. And for me, one of the things that really stood out to me amidst all of the very fun magic tricks that we get to see him do, which I'm guessing some of which may have came from his time in the magic show on Broadway in 1974.
Oh, I didn't know that. Was he what was that? Was it
Oh
a
yes, so the magic show, this is where my theater side pops out, but DOS was in this absolutely terrible musical called The Magic Show, in which he plays a very washed up magician. And so the sort of action of the show revolves around, trying to get him to have this comeback and the other people involved in this giant production. And so that was what he was doing, pre-MASH. And so I'm guessing that's where some of those tricks may have come from and
Oh, that's
why.
funny. I didn't know. I've never heard that. That's great.
You're not missing much. He's very good, but like the show is absolutely forgettable. But one of the tricks that really stood out to me is when he's pulling the flags out of his ear. And as I was doing my rewatch this morning, just going through and tracking some things that I wanted to bring up, I was interested in what flags are actually included on that string. And some of them you can't really tell, but you can make out the USA, you can make out Switzerland with the White Cross, you can make out Thailand, Norway, and the UN flag. I think it's
Interesting.
so interesting that this trick is, featuring the flags of many countries who were involved in the Korean War, and it's the sort of last-ditch attempt to pull it out, and he reveals it, and there's no impact. And I'm not quite sure what the bigger thesis there is, but I think that there's something really interesting about having those visual references for all of these people who are involved in this conflict, and yet we still can't save this soldier. We can't stop this war. We can't stop the endless destruction that's happening. And so that was something that just I never paid attention to until going back through with a fine-tooth comb, being like, okay, there's something. Shout out to the props department there, because the attention to detail was there.
I mean, it's funny when you think about this episode, you wonder how far down the line they plan this one, because clearly
Right.
the props department, the costumes department, the lighting department, they all had something different to do this week, especially the set builders, because they had to build all
Absolutely.
sorts of stuff that they would never have to do. And I got to wonder if, was it like a quarter of the way into season one, they told them, hey, this is coming down the line right near the end. Let's get ready for this, because there's all sorts of stuff. I mean, obviously they go to the 20th Century Fox props department and the costume
Right.
department, to grab a magician's uniform and tailor it to fit David Ogden Stiers' body. But nevertheless, there's a lot here visually that we never see in any other episode of MASH, for Pete's sakes. So we then get a scene that was always cut in syndication. This was the scene I never saw until I got the DVDs, where they're talking about the blood, and we see that they're having to warm up the blood a little because it's so cold that it's freezing, turning it into little bloodsicles. And they're putting it in the pockets of Klinger's coat, and it's being pressed up against his body, and that is warming it up. And so he's doing them four bottles at a time, and we see he puts new bottles in, and then he pulls it up, and it's freezing. And this just gives me the willies, because I'm just so afraid that someone's going to smash into him and he's going to be covered in blood. It's terrible.
Oh, that would be a rough way to go down. Just explosion of lukewarm blood everywhere. Ugh, no. But the scene is very charming. It's cute to see the interaction between Klinger and Mulcahy, and I think again speaks to Klinger's character of somebody who really does want to help. He does not want to be there by any stretch of the imagination, as we see in his dream to come. But he is somebody who always steps up when it's time, when it's called upon. And I appreciate that little glimpse that we get of their dynamic as well.
So then we're back in post-op, and we see that, as I mentioned, all the beds are being turned into bunk beds all of a sudden. I mean, I don't even know how does the 477 have all these mattress springs to have? Like, where do they
Right?
even get all that? Where do they have all these things? But okay, they're turning them all into bunk beds because there's so many patients, and of course, it sounds like a construction site because there's hammering. And so one of the patients, which is a General Coogan, played by Ford Rainey. I love that name, right? That's an old-timey name.
Oh, yeah.
They don't name people like Ford like that anymore. Ford Rainey, born 1908, passed away 2005. God bless him.
Whoa.
Yeah, good run. This guy has been in a bunch of great movies. I'm just going to name a few. The original 310 to Yuma, The Parallax View, Flaming Star with Elvis Presley. He was in episodes of China Beach. So, I mean, this is just great long career of this guy. And he starts complaining. He's like, why the hell are you making so much noise? I'm trying to get some sleep. And they're kind of like, sorry, we have to do this. And he's like, I'm going to talk to your CO. And he says, well, we'll get him as soon as he wakes up. So, and then we see Rainey kind of, excuse me, Coogan, pull the sheet over him because he's really frustrated that he can't get some shut eye here. So.
Typical army, always finding something to complain about, even amidst the very obvious chaos. But again, I like this B plot because it feels so old school to me. It feels like something that could have happened in the earlier years. But there's a little bit more depth to it. It's grounded in how we then see the dreams also affecting how this plot unfolds as well. So.
I like the idea that this general was wounded and like he's out there on the battlefield. He's no
Right.
dilettante, right? He's not
He's doing more than what we've seen from a lot of the other
Yeah.
higher ups.
Yeah, he got he was out there enough to get wounded. Like, okay, good
Right.
for him. He walks walks the walk and talks the talk. So
Exactly.
meanwhile, Mulcahy is doing confession with a sort of just like a little hunk of wood between the face of him and the soldier, kind of giving as much privacy as possible. This is the patient is just is by an actor named Robin Haynes. Only had a couple of credits that I noticed. Hot Dog the movie. Not anything you really want to brag about. He's in the he's in the Mel Brooks and Bancroft movie To Be or Not to Be, at least. So they start talking, and he says, all right, Father, let me do my confession. And he says, it's been 6 months since my last confession. And then he's like, and since that time, I've committed three sins against the sixth commandment. Now, there's a moment here that, for as surreal as this episode is, I think this is the most surrealist piece that you are really expecting the audience to be paying attention. Because
Yep.
as we see, the minute Mulcahy falls asleep, the patient is talking, he immediately goes into gibberish.
Yeah.
He says, in which I trove Sobert into Farley Quince. And he says, to civiller fafflameries with closive in flinches and depressionary farven. And then Mulcahy wakes up again, and then he's back to, and then a month later, we've been up on the line for 28 days. And they give you no indication as what the hell is happening unless you're really paying attention and you realize that's what Mulcahy is hearing because he's half asleep. And I'm like, what a great little detail for them to, there's no visual cue that something weird is happening. You just have to be paying attention. I love that detail.
It's so excellent, and the actor delivers it so well. Like you don't even really notice until you notice, and then we notice with Mulcahy when he wakes himself up, and it's that type of delivery, that specificity of that language, that leads us into this giant surreal scene to unfold. Which, not to show my hand too early, but it is my favorite of the seven sequences that we
Okay.
see because it's so out there, because it's such a departure from what we normally see with Mulcahy, but I won't give away the game too early.
Oh no, I mean, I said it's a this is a masterful sequence. Again, a really sort of grandly shot. We see Mulcahy coming in like he's a pope, through these big doors, and he comes in, and of course everyone in the mess tent is happy. They're cheering, they're thrilled to see him there. Potter is there. I mean, like
Yeah.
Winchester is there, oddly enough, right? Yeah,
Right.
that's kind of a strange little detail. Why would it be Winchester? And so Mulcahy is standing up at his pulpit and he starts his sermon, and we see that the massive crucifix that is hanging just behind him is all of a sudden, well, we first of all we see some drops of blood falling on the Bible that Mulcahy is reading from, and he's just sort of looks confused, and then he looks up, looks down again, more blood, and then we pan back and we see that the Jesus statue has turned into a bloody soldier. And think about the image that this show was broadcasting to 25 million people on
Yeah.
television is we're going to swap out a crucifix for a bloodied soldier. I mean, I don't know if a TV show could get away with that. Actually, no TV show could get away with that nowadays. That would not pass.
No.
It just would not. And yet here was MASH putting a pretty ghastly image in front of a lot of people.
Absolutely. And it's this really striking moment of realization that we see too. As you pointed out, we have the blood dripping onto the pages of the Bible, which is open to the Gospel of John. And I found that
Oh,
sidebar
I would not have
interesting.
known that. Okay.
This was my benefit of finally getting to watch the show on an HD television and being able to pay attention to the details therein. But I was curious as to, okay, I'm not Catholic, let alone Christian. What does this signify in terms of Catholic faith? And so my quick research that I did today, I found out that one of the significant parts of the Gospel of John is the phrase ego eimi, which is I am, and it appears 24 times in this particular book of the Bible, but it refers to this phrase that oftentimes was used by Jesus Christ and refers to moments where he says, like, I am the bread of life, I am the door, I am the good shepherd, which I think is really interesting for Mulcahy in this moment of reflection of what am I doing here? What is my impact? What's happening in this moment? I'm trying to do good, trying to, be as faithful as I can in this insane environment. And that's what he's about to start talking about before he looks up and then
Wow.
sees the figure of the soldier on the cross. But one question I had for you, which comes from the annals of MASH Blur, is that there was a poll going around a while back about who people think the wounded soldier was supposed to represent. Is it supposed to be Christ himself? Is it supposed to be an anonymous soldier? Do people think that Mulcahy may have saw himself on the cross? Is that a question that ever came up for you while watching? And if so, what do you think of the multiple potential meanings therein?
Oh, I always just took it as just generic soldier. It's just that, like in most of these dreams, the wound, the war just spills over into your idealized circumstance. I mean, BJ's idealized circumstance is being with his wife. Klinger's idealized circumstance is being back in Toledo. Margaret's is sort of like, having a husband, I guess. And we know that that was really important to her in a lot of ways. And it the war invades all that. So, we've okay, he has mentioned in previous episodes that he is cognizant that he's not the hot ticket, as he says,
Sure.
and finally he is. He's achieved, he's essentially a pope, I guess they're supposed to be saying,
Right.
or a cardinal, or just, or he's certainly very high up in the organization, as it were. And look what happens. Everyone there is genuflecting, and then what happens, it turns into a war.
Yeah. I find this moment so fascinating when he just looks out over all of the chaos in terms of the mess tent meets chapel meets operating room. The sort of layers of impact and meaning that we see in this moment of realization as he feels completely helpless to do anything to help, it comes from this really fascinating sort of duality with his personality, in that he's somebody who's supposed to be the moral compass on the show. He's fallible, human like the rest of everybody else, and he's someone who's also admittedly egotistical. We see this in Mulcahy's War, where he talks about the fact that he is ambitious. We see this in Captain's, I think in Captain's Outrageous, where he gets turned over for a promotion
Yep.
again. And while he's upset about these, very human things, this thing that's totally out of his control, the war, is what lands immediately in this moment. And again, William Christopher just gives a fantastic performance wordlessly in this moment, with those tight shots on his face as we see just the guilt, the helplessness, the sort of loss for what to do. And then we're just dropped right back in with this kid's confession, which he's been sleeping through, but the poor guy.
I love when he's like, "Do I have to say all that again?" And he's like, "You skip the details, just give me the highlights."
Just the
And he's
highlights.
Father Frieson. You're like, oh, "Okay, all right." So, by the way,
And he's
you
con sorry, go ahead. I mean to cut you
no,
off.
you go.
One of the things that also stuck out to me was the fact that he's confessing to murder. The sixth commandment that he's broken three times is, you shall not murder. And Mulcahy is somebody who's pretty much a pacifist, but he'll still punch your lights out if the occasion calls for it. Inadvertently misses this whole very vulnerable confession. And I think speaks to, again, the complicated nature of his position as a chaplain in the middle of a war, is how do you forgive somebody for something that, you've either been conscripted into or volunteered to do, and you know what's coming with being a regular soldier in the army in Korea? How do you hold these things? How do you ask for that forgiveness? And the show doesn't give us that answer. It gives us Mulcahy falling asleep and then asking this poor kid to confess the whole thing again. But again, brings up those interesting questions of how Mulcahy's role functions within this world.
That's again, that's a great detail you caught. Like with the thing with it being what Bible passage is open to, because that's clearly just for them, because
Right.
nobody was going to be, there's no HD in 1980.
Exactly.
So that's just for, they knew nobody was going to catch that, but that was just somebody in the prop department or somebody in the set deck department that decided where what page you're going to put it on. Let's put it on that. Maybe it was William
Exactly.
Christopher. We'll never know. But
Right.
yeah, those are great details. That's the commandment, right? That he chose to talk about is
Yeah.
that one. Even though the story gets much sillier soon after that.
Right.
So then we're back in post-op, and Potter is talking to General Coogan, and he explains about that this lieutenant won't order the ambulances, and Coogan is basically like, well, if I could talk to him, I would boil his bars. And Potter's like, I think we can arrange that. And he asks Nurse Kelly to go find Klinger to run a line, which means we are now with Klinger, and he's getting a few Z's in the supply tent. And all of a sudden, we see him sort of rocking back and forth, and we hear a train announcer, and he says, Toledo, next stop. And he takes off his coat, wanders out, and then we see we are on we're in the streets of Toledo. This is the same exact street that Captain Kirk and Mr. Spock ran around in when they went back in time for The City on the Edge of Forever, one of the most famous episodes of Star Trek, where they go back they go back to the United States in the 1930s, and this is literally the same thing. So presumably, I don't think this is the Fox lot. I think this was another lot that they borrowed because the studios were always constantly kind of doing that for one another. And we see there's some signs. It says Bowling Green, Sandusky. There's a sign at one point that says Farah on it, and that is Jamie Farr's real name, Farah. And then he finds his way to a Tony Paco's, and he wipes the glass, and who's inside? But of course, Colonel Potter looking as grim as he's looked in any of these dreams,
Absolutely.
right? The
Here
way
he
he,
feels distinctly, if not antagonistic, then certainly ominous in
The
his
ominous,
presence.
great. What that's the word, ominous, because he is frowning, and the way he does the little finger thing, like "come on in here," and we see that the patient that Klinger is that Potter is working on is Klinger himself, and we see Jamie Farr. Klinger starts to get a little mushy-eyed. He was great, great cry, great dewy-eyed actor, Jamie Farr. And then we hear the voice of Nurse Kelly. And then she finds him, and she's like, "You know, Colonel Potter wants you to run a phone line in the next 2 minutes." And of course, Klinger at this point is thrilled, and he says, "Thank you, Lieutenant. Those are the sweetest words I've ever heard. I'm alive. I'm alive." And of course, she's looking sort of like, "What?" And then he even gives her a kiss on the mouth.
Which I'm glad it was Kelly. I do love the little bits of the Klinger Kelly dynamic that we've seen over the years with them, casually going out on dates or dancing together at the club. And I'm glad that we get another little hint of their friendship in this moment.
No, I'm just going to say the next scene is with where General Coogan talking to the lieutenant, where he says, "All right, Lieutenant, I want to hear your reason why you won't send the ambulances in the flesh. Come down here and tell me." And that gets the lieutenant to say, "They're on their way now, sir." So he realized that
It's
if.
so good. And I love that we also see Mulcahy's guy in the background of that scene too.
Oh,
We
did
can't
we?
tell
I
if
don't
he's
even
still
notice. Oh,
talking.
that's funny.
It's so brief and he's in the like far back corner of the shot, but it looks like he's kind of mumbling something. So it could be that his confession is still going on at this point.
That's great.
But yeah, I like the little framing that we have of the B plot. It doesn't feel like it takes away from the surreality and strangeness of the dreams, but it does give us a nice through line to ground how these all connect back to one another.
Then we basically the crisis is over, and then we find Margaret and Potter in the mess tent. They mentioned 211 patients in 33 hours, which is
Unimaginable.
that I don't I mean obviously some of those patients are pretty minor, but some of them are pretty severe. So that's incomprehensible that four doctors could manage that. I mean, that's a what you know that's what 50 patients each in not even a day and a half. 50 patients, 50. Like, what?
It's like a patient every 45 minutes, nonstop. It's unimaginable
Unimaginable.
effort and exhaustion come with that.
I love Margaret's retort. She goes, "Well, it's good to know we could do it." I love that Margaret's always finding the upside to this, which is like, I don't know. Is it? I mean, if someone beat you
Right.
within an inch of your life and you survived, would you say, "Boy, I'm glad I know I could take that kind of punishment"? I don't. I think it's kind of bad. I don't, but
Right,
that's
I might
Margaret.
be a little more complaining than everybody else, but I appreciate her reframe, so to
Margaret is
speak.
Margaret, right? Margaret's always going to look at it from some sort of military point of view, which is, well, at least we know we could do it. Well, all right,
Right.
I guess. All right, I guess so. And so then we pan out and we see that Winchester is there wearing his tobogganing hat that he
We love to
got
see
in
it.
season seven, which is a nice little detail. Again, MASH, not always great with continuity, but nice that they kept that around. Hawkeye joins them, is exhausted. And they have this little bit about where Winchester won't eat his meat because he's kind of looking at it, and Winchester's like, "I'm deciding whether or not whether to eat it," and then he and it just looks disgusting, right? It's just this kind of
Ugh.
gray slab of liver. Hawkeye tries to cut into it, he can't cut into it, and he says, "Is it liver or am I sleep changing attire?" And then Potter says, "Why don't you get a nap and go back to the swamp and get a nap?" And Hawkeye says, "Why? That's too much trouble," and he passes out right there at the table. And then we're introduced to Hawkeye's dream, where we meet his professor. Now, I think this is the only episode of MASH ever featuring a professor, so it's sort of eerily funny that we have a professor as a guest in the one episode that features a professor in the plot. So, okay.
Yeah, shout out to Fred Stuthman,
Fred
such a great
Stuffman.
character actor. He's so good in everything. I don't know if you're familiar at all with Jeepers Creepers Theater, the LA show that was on in the 60s, but that's what I knew him from, like being a big fan of Elvira and other shows like that.
Yeah, he was a
That
horror
was
host. He was a
He was a
horror host.
horror host, and he's so good and very campy, which you wouldn't get from many of his other appearances on shows where he's sort of
Yeah.
buttoned up, and even if he's comic relief, still sort of, the square, the heavy. But that, and of course his features on Hello, Larry are career highlights. So.
I did not even include that in my rundown of him. He was born in 1919, passed away in 1982. So this was kind of like one of the last things he was going to do. He's in movies like Escape from Alcatraz, which is a classic. I love that movie. He's in Network, Marathon Man. He's in a terrific, really crazy ass horror movie called The Sentinel with Chris Sarandon in that. It's not a movie a lot of people have seen, but boy, is it bonkers. And he is playing a professor. Now, we don't know, we'll never know whether this is actually one of Hawkeye's professors or this is just a dream that Hawkeye's having and this is just a random person. And he asks Hawkeye about some piece of, medical procedure, and Hawkeye can't answer because he was sleeping. And he says, "Give me your left arm, please." And we cut back and we see that, of course, Hawkeye's arms have turned into mannequin arms, which is a nice surrealist way of pulling this off, obviously. If we did this nowadays, they would CGI it and they would literally be pulling his arms off, but they can't do that in 1980. But this is a nice way of just getting it across of like, okay, in the dream, his arms have turned to mannequin arms. So he hands the arm to the professor, who chucks it. Well, first of all, he goes over to a soldier missing an arm and he's like, "This man would like his arm back. Can you reattach it?" And of course, poor Hawkeye can't
Right.
do that. And I love the way he was, he's, "I'm sleeping. I don't know." Like he's so flummoxed. And we see the professor throw it off screen and we hear it land in some water. And then he says, "Your right arm, please." And he can't remove his own arm. He's only got one left.
Right.
And he asks Winchester to do it, which Winchester does silently and pulls Hawkeye's arm off. And then the professor throws that arm into the river, and we see that the river is full of severed limbs. They're all mannequin limbs, but they're all severed limbs. And then we see Hawkeye in a rowboat with no oars and no arms as he floats helplessly down this river. We see a young Korean girl with an injury because she's covered in blood, and she sort of reaches out to Hawkeye for help, and he has to bow his head in shame because he cannot help her. And so again, pretty hoary images to put in front of 20, 25 million Americans in 1980.
Absolutely. It's so haunting, and it's achieved with such minimal, technological needs. Just the mannequin arm coming off, it's just immediately uncanny, and it really taps into that fear of this doesn't look right. This looks not human, not natural. Something is deeply wrong. And to me, that sequence where they're removing Hawkeye's arms reminds me so much of what we heard discussed a couple episodes back in Heal Thyself, where poor Steve Newsome is just like, there's so many arms and legs you see. And whether or not this is an intentional callback or not, it's the first image that comes to mind of Steve just sitting there with the fact that the blood can't come off. He just can't separate himself from the violence. And I think that that's something that they really tap into. And again, that back half of season eight is okay, we've been here for 8 years of the 3 year conflict. How do we see this start to psychologically really start to take its toll on our favorite characters? And Hawkeye's dream is very much a good representation of that. And then Charles is there. Why Charles is there? This is a question that I have. But yeah, it's interesting to see who has different impact in others' dreams as well.
It would have been, I mean, I know it's because Winchester was sitting there when he was awake, but it would have been like an even more of a, like, would have been even more jarring to see like BJ do it. Like,
Or
that would have
Henry, or
been,
Trapper, or
well, okay.
Radar.
Yes. Let's put a pin on that. Let's put a pin on that.
We'll
I want
come
to get
back.
back to that in a moment. So Hawkeye then wanders onto the dirt, and there's a patient on an operating table, and a nurse hands him a scalpel. And of course, he doesn't have any arms, and he screams to the heavens, no. That wakes him up, and we hear that more choppers have arrived. There's even more wounded, even though they weren't supposed to be coming. And so he trudges off out of the mess tent to take care of that. And that's the act break. That's the end of the main part of the episode. Then we come back, and we've got our whole cast sitting there, and they're talking about how tired they all are. And they say, well, we're going to go back to our tents and take a nap. And that's when Winchester, being who he is, has to quote something literary and says, you know, sleep perchance to dream. And that gives everybody pause. And I love the idea that none of them have told each other, right? Like, I don't get the sense that any of them have said to the other, man, I had a crazy ass dream, right? Maybe Hawkeye and BJ have, maybe Margaret and Potter, but probably not. Probably not.
No.
Because they
They
all
probably haven't
silent.
had time either.
Yeah,
Like, they
that too,
probably
right? They
just
probably just literally
dove
have not
right
even had the
in.
time. And so that stops them all. They sit down and they all decide to have another cup of coffee and they talk about keeping us warm. And then we get the sad, super sad version of Suicide is Painless, last heard on the Goodbye Radar Part 2 episode. And that's dreams, everybody. That's MASH. Go back to your lives in 1980 America. Enjoy Jimmy Carter as president or whatever's in the box office. But that's MASH, everybody. So there you go.
That's it. That's all you need. Sums up the
Whew.
show perfectly.
So, okay, getting back to what you just said, my one, I don't even want to say this is a complaint because it's not a, you can't complain about something when it was unrealistic. But my one tight, small, tight little thing about this episode is that except for Potter's, it's the same idea. It's they're all nightmarish. The war has invaded your dreams. Okay, great, but it's kind of the same idea six times. It would have been amazing. And again, they were never going to do this, but it would have been amazing to bring Henry or Trapper or Frank Burns or even Radar. I mean, Gary Berghoff was probably not in the mood to come back at this point
Probably
and so
not.
soon. But, and if they really wanted to mess with people's heads, have like Hawkeye dream, have Hawkeye's dream be like what the show looked like in 1972, right? With like Trapper in it and Henry and a laugh track, like, really make people's heads explode by doing that. Now, they were never going to do that. But it's like there was an opportunity to really mess with people's heads if they wanted to, and they obviously they were never going to do it. I've mentioned this before a bunch of years ago. I had an interview with Elias Davis, one of the MASH writers, and I asked him about this very thing when they did the episode where there's a will, there's a war, because that features flashbacks. And I said, was there ever any idea you could bring back the other actors? And he said, no. Our job was to give stuff to the seven main cast members. We weren't going out of our way to bring in guest stars. So saying that the show should have done that is ridiculous because they were never going to do it. But nevertheless, if they were ever going to, this would have been the moment to do it.
This would have been so impactful. Or bring in a character who we haven't seen. Have Hawkeye dream about his dad.
Yeah,
Like
Ben
if
Pierce,
we're
right?
having some reference to the outside world or the
Mildred.
idea of home, like show us the people we haven't seen. And we get
Anoria,
that
yeah.
a little bit with Peg, who this is her intro, so I will give them props there. And also props for the continuity with bringing back the same actress. But I totally wholeheartedly agree with you in that the formulas are very similar. We do see some variation therein, but this would be a really interesting opportunity, especially for the people who have had the biggest impact on Hawkeye, how he is where he is now, and thinking about also how do we get to goodbye, farewell, and amen at the end of the show. I think this is one of those key pivotal episodes to see how his psyche is being particularly affected. So, a missed opportunity, but very fun to speculate about in terms of who could have had that massive impact in that moment.
Right. They were again, this was 1980. You shows didn't bring back old cast members. Like you just didn't. Nowadays, shows know that they have fandoms that are paying attention. That's a more modern thing to do. They just did not do that in 1980. But I just thought, well, if they're ever going to do it would have been. Can you imagine how that would have screwed with people's heads, right? If all of a sudden the show had looked like it did in 1972 and it had a laugh track and it had Henry, it would have been like, what? Like, why? You know, it would have been absolutely insane. But, and it, look, this is a downer of an episode. It just is. And maybe that's why people had that reaction. Like, oh, maybe I'll take dreams if there's nobody else wants it. You know, maybe so, but I've always liked this one because it is so format busting. They only did it the one time. You know, it's not like in the days where shows nowadays have eight episodes. If you do one whole episode devoted to dreams, you're maybe a little like, wow, that's a lot of real estate you've spent. But this is MASH's longest season. There's 25 episodes this season. They can do one that's a real format buster, and they did it. And I thought overall they pulled it off.
Absolutely. I wholeheartedly agree. I love this episode. I don't think it's the best episode of the show. I think you can make the argument for many other stronger episodes, but it's single-handedly such an impactful experimental half hour of television that I think it has so much weight for what it is. Also, as somebody who does a lot of research specifically about politics and horror, it's one of the classes that I teach. I find the fact that there's not a whole lot of war horror as a sort of subgenre of genre horror, broadly speaking, to really be out there, especially at this period in, general pop culture. You have some Twilight Zone episodes which refer to the war and, certainly lean into the supernatural and surreal elements therein. There's a couple, films ranging from the interesting to the sleazy, examining the figure of the Vietnam vet as potentially, a psychological killer, which I think has too many complicated politics to get into here now. But Bob Clark's Death Dream is a good
I was just
example
about to
of
ask, have
that.
you seen Death Dream? That's the
It's
first one I thought of.
spectacular. Like the idea of this reimagining of the monkey's paw, framing this story through the idea of a soldier who's come back, thinking about the metaphor of, post-traumatic stress disorder as framed through the horror device. But there's not a whole lot else out there at this stage. And then you can make the argument for Apocalypse Now as a horror film, and I do when I teach it. But I think that what I find so fascinating about 20th century horror, and specifically the impact of war on the genre in general, is that we really get our general broad understanding of the phrase horror from the impact of World War I. And there's a great book out there called Wasteland: The Great War and the Origins of Modern Horror by W. Scott Poole, in which he gives a lot of good insight into the impact of modern warfare on how horror as a genre evolves. And so before, not to get too in the weeds on this, but for context, before World War I, use of the term horror really is in reference to literature and theater, but referring to that sort of physical repulsion and intense distress rather than a specific genre. And so in this book, he makes the argument that because we have a very different understanding of death coming out of World War I, people have a different understanding of what people's bodies look like. He calls them nightmare bodies, uncanniness of corpses and doppelgangers, which we see in Klinger's Dream, zombies, which we almost even see in that moment of BJ turning away from Peg. All of this are things are, that are both familiar but unfamiliar. And it's that uncanniness that helps to shape our understanding of that unheimlich, that sort of uncanny effect that somebody like Freud would talk about. And I think that this episode really ties into that idea of we've been with these characters in this dramedy for 8 seasons. We're going to go really in a different direction in terms of tone, but how do we understand this as part of a broader understanding of the genre and the ways in which war directly has this impact of what scares us, what freaks us out, what makes this feel so surreal in that sense? So for that, I give everybody on the team, Alan Alda et al., huge props for going so weird with it and putting this on primetime TV in 1980, because people did not know what they were about to see unfold.
Yeah, I mean, I think a show that either had less ratings power or was newer just would not have been able to get this through. The network would have just said,
Certainly
"No, you're
not.
not doing that." But MASH had enough heft to say at this point, we could, they're going to get what they want for the most part. And yeah, I mean, I've as a devotee of movies and horror movies specifically, like I know I've seen a lot of horror documentaries, but they've talked about that World War I was the first war that people could come back from it mangled, but still alive. And any war previous to that, you just died.
Right, it was
But all of
over.
a sudden, people were having to, quote unquote, deal with veterans coming back with missing faces or, miss it, like been mangled in a way as a reminder of what they have been through. And that is something as a society they had to deal with. You had to bring these people into society, or maybe not in some cases you didn't,
Right.
but that idea. But so yeah, there is not a lot of war. I'm good. I'm so glad that you mentioned Death Dream, because that was literally the first film I thought of was, well, there's Death Dream, directed by Bob Porky's and A Christmas Story Clark. That's a terrific dark little movie. But yeah, this is a horror episode. This is a real horror episode. I mentioned at the top of the show, it is written by Alan Alda and James J. Rubenfear. Who the hell is James J. Rubenfear? I did some research. I could find not a single piece of information on Mr. Rubenfear. He has no other credits on IMDb. There are no pictures. I found no interviews with him either contemporarily or at the time when this episode aired. Nothing. It is as if Mr. Rubenfear does not exist. So, not content with that information, I reached out to our man on the inside, Mike Farrell, and asked him, "Who the hell is James J. Rubenfear? Did you ever deal with this guy? I mean, what happened?" And so this is what Mike said. "Alan wrote a lot by himself, but sometimes with the staff. I don't know that name, and I think there's probably a joke hidden in there somewhere." So that sort of underscores what I thought was that's a pseudonym for somebody,
It
because
must be.
there's just no way that there are some people on, we know some writers have written one episode of MASH and they've never written another one, but they've written other things. They've gotten other credits. It seems improbable to me that this person could write one of the most renowned episodes of the show and simply disappear off the face of the earth. Never interviewed for a book, a TV guide, a retrospective, nothing. And so that tells me that Mr. James J. Rubenfear does not exist.
I appreciate the intel that we get in all of that. But that is so funny to me. Like, I wonder, in the event that it was a pseudonym, I wonder if they were going to pass it off of, oh, this was Ruben Fear's idea, so we will not be bringing him back on staff. It's fine, don't worry about
Damn
it. Right?
that
Right? This is very much it. I could see that being a potential route that they went.
Yeah, so we'll unless I ever get to meet Alan Alda, and who knows, hope springs eternal. Jane Fonda knows I exist. Maybe Alan Alda will at some point too. Yeah, we may never know who James J. Reuben Fear actually is. But yeah, just when I saw that I could find nothing, I went, no, there's something's fishy. So okay, now this is going to be difficult because this is the point where I'm going to ask you if you have a favorite line or joke. There were hardly any jokes in this episode, so the pickings are slim. But do you have a favorite line or joke from this episode?
Ooh, that is a good question, especially given that, as we've talked about, this episode is fairly wordless for a lot of those main dream sequences. But I am a big fan of Klinger going, "I'm alive, I'm alive." And what I find so fascinating about that sequence as well is that alongside Potter's, it's the only one that we see, a sense of home with. Klinger is all about home. He's all about getting back to Toledo, even if Toledo looks very much like a backlot, potentially an MGM one. The fact that he is able to, again, just refocus and celebrate the simple fact of being alive. And again, the smooch with Kelly is played for physical comedy. But any moment that we get to see him have this little brief stint of joy amidst all of the chaos, just selfishly just warms my heart. I like seeing him have those little moments of levity throughout because he is so often played for comic relief. The fact that we get to actually see him take joy in something amidst all of the other ongoing, constant chaos is sweet.
You get the sense that maybe that the dreams might haunt Hawkeye and Winchester and Margaret and BJ and Mulcahy, but Klinger's is just happy to be out of it. And so, and then of course he's a mission immediately commissioned into doing something. So he's got to have his mind on something else now. It's like, oh, I got to make the phone call. So he's put it, I think, in that moment, he's put it behind him. It's like, that was a bad dream. I'm afraid of dying. Who isn't afraid of that? Let's move on, that kind of thing. So yeah, he may handle it a little bit better than some other people. So for me, this isn't much of a joke, but again, the pickings are slim. It's when the soldier is confessing to Mulcahy and he's doing the gibberish, and then at one point he says, and in gibberish, he goes, "But fringes are gerbil, you know?" I like that it's both gibberish and English. And you can maybe sense that he's like, but fringes are gerbil. You could maybe know what he's saying. Like, well, girls are really attractive or girls are pretty. Like, he's saying something that maybe you could figure out. But I just like the way he has the, but fringes are gerbil, Like, yeah, of course, fringes are gerbil. We all know
Of course they
that.
are. We all know
So
that. It's
we all know that.
great.
We all know that. It's great. So, well, Maddie, we did it. That is Dreams. Everybody, a big episode. I was so excited to finally get to cover this one. And so I'm glad that you wanted to do this, Maddie, and it was absolutely fantastic talking to you.
Thank you so much again for having me. Truly a massive pleasure and privilege to get to be in conversation about this particular episode with you. And again, I'm so grateful for this show, also in particular, like thinking about the number of folks who I've connected with through our shared love of the podcast, has been, just another highlight of finding that online community of all different folks from different walks of life whose shared main interest is the show MASH, and to be able to bring together so many disparate people through this work is truly commendable. So thank you for all that you do with the show, broadly speaking.
Well, thank you. I will tell you, two of the regulars, Doctors Ange and Chris Lewis, who've been on the show multiple times, they met each other online through me, and now they have met. They have gotten together in real life. Ange went over to England and met Dr. Chris, and they've hung out together.
Amazing.
I've not met Dr. Chris. I've never been to England. I've certainly met Ange. Ange was at my wedding, but I'm kind of jealous, right? Because I wanted to be there, but I'm also very pleased that they got together through meeting on MASHcast. That makes me feel good. So there you go. The show is doing some valuable things. Why don't you tell people where they can find you out on the internet?
Absolutely. So I am on Instagram at Maddie, Maedw, and I'll spell out the whole thing. It's Maddie, Maddie, Maedw. And folks can also reach me via email at maddie.williams.1997@gmail.com. And those in the know of Mashblur know where to find me over there. But always happy to chat about Mash, about horror, any other topic that folks are interested in. Hit my line.
Is 1997 what I think it is?
It might be. Yeah. I'm sorry to disappoint.
Not disappointment. It's not disappointment, Maddie. It's just the encroaching, my encroaching decrepitude as we head on here. So I had a job in 1997. Okay, all right. So anyway, thank you. Thank you. I'm gonna have a nightmare tonight, that's for damn sure. Thank you all for listening. Of course, you could find all the back episodes of this show on our website, FireandWaterPodcast.com. You can find me on Blue Sky under Rob Kelly Creative. And if you want to support the Fire and Water Podcast Network, please go to patreon.com/FW Podcast, and there you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name checked on a show of your choice. So a big dreamlike salute to Adam Ackerman, Dennis Bailey, Daryl Clark, James K, Michael Kelly, David Mann, Matt McLean, Lisa P, Brady Palmer, Joe Perino, Stan Peel, Michael Porter, Nicholas Palm, Rob Riley, Adam Sanders, Stephanie Van Schaik, Rich Ram, Billy Shulman, and Mike Thomas. Thank you all so much. Again, thank you so much for listening. We will be back next week, but until then, that is all.
Damn. Can't make my fingers work.
Slight case of surgeon's cramp.
Somebody take over for him.
I'm fine.
Connie, how'd you like the clothes?
I thought you'd never ask.